On the program today, some supply chain stories. We will go back to the office and we'll get some takeout. What are you kind of hankering for anyway? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Wednesday today, the 9th day of September. Good as always to have you along, everybody. There are days, and this is one of them, where what's going on right now in this economy isn't actually about what's going on right now in this economy. Today's example comes to us in the form of a new report from the National Retail Federation, which says that pandemic aside and global trade unease notwithstanding, we were importing more stuff into this economy in August than circumstances might warrant. Record imports, quite possibly. Marketplace's Justin Ho explains what that might be telling us.
This year, the Port of Los Angeles went from handling the lowest container volumes it had seen in over a decade to taking in near record levels of imports.
August will be one of the best months we've had in our port's history.
Gene Soroka is the port's executive director.
And September right now is looking to be very strong as well from our forward indications.
That's because supply chains have started to come back. Big box retailers are restocking shelves. Plus, online shopping jumped over 30% in the second quarter.
So those inventories have to be replenished.
People have also been buying a lot of bulky items to set up home offices. Desks, chairs, computer monitors, and that filled up a lot of shipping containers too. Jonathan Gold follows supply chain policy for the National Retail Federation. He says this is also the time of year when retailers start preparing for the holiday season, when, during normal times, we buy each other a lot of stuff.
Whether it's, you know, apparel, consumer electronics, furniture, home goods, toys, all that comes from the Asian market.
But these are not normal times. Dale Rogers is a professor of supply chain management at Arizona State University. He says by building up their inventories, stores are betting that the consumer will feel comfortable buying things this holiday season.
There's a belief that the consumer is going to be there, but they're not necessarily there yet.
Still, consumers have fewer ways to spend their money this year. Travel is still difficult. Restaurants have limited capacity. Ishwar Prasad is a professor of trade policy at Cornell University. He says for those who have a holiday budget,
people have to spend their money on something.
Prasad says when we can't spend much on experiences and other services, we're likely to spend more on goods. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
One of the biggest would-be acquisitions ever in the luxury industry is no more. LVMH, which owns Louis Vuitton and Marc Jacobs and Fendi, to name just a couple, is backing out of a $16 billion deal it made a year or so ago to buy Tiffany. There are allegations of bad faith and lawsuits pending, but as Marketplace's Kristen Schwab reports, you know, the pandemic has kind of hit the luxury market, too.
Visiting the Tiffany's flagship store on Fifth Avenue in New York can feel like going to a museum, except everything's for sale and comes with a glass of champagne.
A lot of consumers go to the store because they want that experience, but also because a lot of luxury retailers don't really make it that easy to shop online.
Alexis DeSalva at Mintel says just 50% of luxury consumers have shopped online, compared to 80% of traditional retail. Part of that is because it's harder for shoppers to justify dropping thousands of dollars without ever touching a product. And during the pandemic, the in-store shopping experience has suffered. Tiffany's revenues were down nearly 30% in the last quarter. Many luxury shoppers are tourists, another thing that's been hurt by COVID-19.
People will brag about where they bought their luxury goods.
Joseph Nunes is a marketing professor at USC.
They like to buy souvenirs that remind them of vacations or events.
Events. Let's see. What's a big event that involves jewelry that people are postponing right now? Oh, yeah. Weddings. Again, here's Mintel's Alexis DeSalva.
People are probably not heading to Tiffany's for an engagement ring or an anniversary present.
COVID aside, LVMH said in a statement that the French government wanted it to delay the deal because the U.S. is threatening to impose taxes on French products. Here's USC's Nunes again.
Part of it sounds like a strategy to wait out what's going to happen with the tariffs.
Nunes says LVMH might try to come through later with another deal, likely at a lower price. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
Shares of Tiffany, ticker symbol a way too easy, TIF, by the way, down 6.5% today. A rare loser on this Wednesday. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Houston-based Luby's says it's going to dissolve all of its businesses, sell all of 77 of its Luby's cafeterias and 30 company-owned Fuddruckers, that's a burger joint, and it's going to distribute the proceeds to shareholders. You don't hear about companies doing that a lot. Usually there's a bankruptcy filing, then a restructuring or some kind of sale. Luby's, though, is out. Everything must go, real estate, equipment, you name it. And as Marketplace's Andy Euler reports, other restaurants in this pandemic economy may well follow suit.
When a restaurant decides to call it quits, it has a few options. If it owns the building, H.G. Parsa at the University of Denver says it can usually sell the real estate quite easily.
Restaurants don't have that many transaction-specific assets. That means a restaurant building can be converted to something else very easily.
But what about the tables and chairs, the stoves and knives? Well, that depends on what the new owner intends to do with the building. If it's going to be another restaurant, they'll probably just include that restaurant stuff in the deal. Or they might call Greg Christian to help get rid of it.
Yeah, that's what we do.
He runs Auction Masters in suburban Minneapolis. He says after he gets together with the business owner and maybe a banker and a landlord, they set an auction date. And who's in the market for used restaurant equipment in the middle of a pandemic? Other restaurants.
It's the small guy upgrading, changing things, changing their venue, whatever they're trying to do to stay alive in this market.
He says a few things are getting top dollar right now.
Umbrellas this summer. Wow. I've never seen umbrellas go so high. And any patio furniture. Oh, my goodness. Those prices were high.
That's because expanding a restaurant's patio, if the city and landlord allows it, has become the go-to move for sit-down restaurants. Amit Sharma at Penn State says there's another strong market for used ovens and grills, the nonprofit sector, like soup kitchens and food banks.
These people have been cooking food for those who are in need for food, you know, don't have access. So yeah, you know, they're places like such that can use equipment.
And he says because so many restaurants are struggling and might have to liquidate soon, a lot of that equipment still has some life in it. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Everything has changed in this economy. We have said that a bunch of times. School, work, consumers, how we eat, what we buy, everything. But in a way, some of it's not new. I'm talking about restaurants and food and the change they have had to make from everybody eating in to so many more of us taking out. Because the whole idea of us getting a quick bite to eat on the go has been around since the Aztecs and the ancient Romans. So we got a food historian on the phone to talk about the economics of takeout. Emmeline Rood is the editor of Eaton magazine. Emmeline, thanks for coming on.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Let me start with this. And it's, you know, it's playing off the history of takeout, and it's long. But when does it become recognizable to us? When does it take the form that we know it in today?
Yeah. So obviously, everyone knows street food. And that has existed in the United States four centuries. The concept of takeaway as sort of a separate thing. In the 17th century, a choice few number of hotels would offer takeaway meals to people who would send their servants to pick them up. It was accessible to the rich at first.
And then when does delivery become a thing as opposed to, you know, going to pick it up and taking it someplace?
So delivery is a little different because it requires more labor. And so it's only until in the 20th century that all of a sudden you get an emerging middle class with more money to spend, interested in more leisure activities, and that includes eating out at restaurants or getting that same high-quality food at their own home. the earliest known record that we have, I mean, obviously, as a historian, it's not the best to say the earliest, but there's an advertisement in a Los Angeles newspaper in 1922 from a place called Kin Chu Cafe in L.A., and they advertised that they were the only place on the West Coast making and delivering real Chinese food, and you could call some man named Douglas anytime between 11 a.m. and 1 a.m., and he would bring you Chinese food.
So get anecdotal for me here for a minute. So it used to be, before you could pull up these menus on your phones, that people had, I mean, we certainly had, takeout menus stuffed in a drawer in the kitchen. What did early takeout menus look like, right? I mean, they must have been fairly rudimentary, yeah?
Well, it's very interesting because there aren't really takeout menus until probably the 50s or the 60s. So what my guess is that people would either be familiar with the restaurant menu or they would call Douglas. And Douglas would tell them what's going on today. Because it wasn't standard. Restaurants didn't make the bread and butter off of delivery food until much later.
A lot of us now simply can't go out to our favorite places, right? Either because we don't feel safe or because the government won't approve indoor dining or outdoors in any measure, right? So we are doing more takeout. But this is not the first time that people or a group of people have been excluded from restaurants, right? Either gender or certainly in race in this economy.
Oh, no. I mean, if you go back to the earliest history of restaurants, basically it was only white men of a certain income bracket. It's quite interesting. If you read articles from even the New York Times, they're so amazed. They have one that is ridiculous, that a woman went out to lunch and knew how to order off of a menu. And it was so significant that it made the New York Times.
That she was able to order by herself? Was that the thing?
Yeah, they wrote a whole article about how well this woman could order off of a lunch menu.
Wow.
Which is, I mean, maybe there was some satire to it. I wasn't around back when it was written. But these were very much establishments for only a certain number of people.
Yeah.
So women were excluded for a very long time. And basically, if you were a racial minority, the most egregious, obviously, is segregation and Jim Crow. So if you were black in America and you were traveling, you were away from home, or if you wanted to eat out at a restaurant, most of them wouldn't serve you. So takeaway was the only option for a large number of Americans.
Emmeline Rood is a food historian. She's also the editor of Eaten magazine. Thanks a lot. I really enjoyed this.
Yeah, thank you.
If you want to know more about this, and you should because it's totally interesting, we've got a link to an article that Emmeline wrote a couple of years ago on the topic at hand. It is, of course, at marketplace.org. Coming up.
In the moment, yeah, it feels like a black eye, but black eyes heal.
Well, that's one metaphor for this economy, sure. First, though, let's do the numbers. All right, here you go. This is what you call a bounce back, right? Dow Industrials rebounded 439 points, 1.6%, 27,940. The NASDAQ up 293, that's 2.7%, finished at 11,141. The S&P 500 advanced 67 points, 2%, 33.98. Tech companies led the way. Apple, just for instance, rose about 4% today. Some coronavirus vaccine developers appeared to reap a benefit from the news that AstraZeneca is pausing global trials of its COVID vaccine candidate after a study subject became sick. Life-saving vaccination is, as you know, a business. Shares of Novavax gained more than 6%. Moderna picked up 4.7%. BioNTech found 4.1%. Today, you're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There were some internet problems in the shed attached to my garage up at the house today, so we find ourselves, well, I do anyway, in the studios in a nearly deserted Marketplace World headquarters in downtown Los Angeles. And I'll tell you, it's weird. It's familiar, but completely not. And a lot of people are having that same reaction as they go back to their offices for the first time since March to get an office chair or a plant or some supplies as they realize they're going to be working from home for a while. It's bizarre, honestly, and kind of emotional, too. Marketplace's Mariel Segarra asked some people to record themselves as they made the trek back.
It's a Saturday morning in late August, and Tony Orr is sitting in his car outside his office building in a suburb of Philadelphia. Orr is a lawyer for a solar power company. He came back to grab some stuff. He hasn't been here since March.
Driving in, and now that I'm looking at the front door, it's that weird mix of, like, really familiar and totally foreign.
Like when you walk around your old high school or hometown.
I'm going to throw on some rubber gloves so that I don't have to touch anything inside, and my mask, and head on in.
Orr takes the elevator to the third floor. He's been really cautious during the pandemic, so he's a little nervous when he gets there and sees some lights on.
Hopefully that doesn't mean somebody's here, but I guess I will find out.
On a different morning, across the country in Seattle, Vincent Chan is leaving his house, rare for a weekday. He's in his car at a stoplight, on the way to pick up some things from the office, like a photo of his husband and their dog that he kept on his desk.
I really miss this morning sun, actually. It's nice to be outside.
Chan, who works at a fintech startup downtown, used to have this routine. He'd wake up around 5:30 in the morning, go for a run, shower, and then head to the office. But these days,
I do things that maybe aren't so great, like just roll out of bed and hop directly into work with a bowl of cereal in my hand.
Outside his company suite on the 21st floor, he has to take his temperature with a no-touch thermometer on the wall.
97.6. Should be good to go.
He scans his security card at the door. It won't open. Back in Pennsylvania, Tony Orr gets through his office door just fine. No one's around.
It's really weird being in here. A few of my colleagues have been coming in from time to time. Looks like one of them completely redecorated his office.
He walks down the hall.
All right, here is my office. Everything just as I left it.
Like a pile of receipts, which he's not sure he ever submitted for reimbursement. His final stop is the fridge. He's looking for some craft beers a coworker gave him in March.
Ah, the drawer is empty. Darn.
Beer theft aside, he says he does miss his coworkers, but not much else.
You know, commuting in, I was thinking, okay, well, I don't really miss driving every day. Sort of mixed feelings as I grab my box and head back out to the parking lot.
He says he can't imagine doing 5 days a week in the office again. In Seattle, Vincent Chan is stuck in the vestibule outside his locked office, looking through the glass. The furniture has been moved around, and he notices
there's a giant Pikachu over there that used to be at someone's desk, and he's sitting in one of the chairs that isn't upside down. It's weird. I miss it.
He gets a message from HR. They can't get a hold of the person who could give him badge access, so Chan is not getting in today.
I don't have any more reason to be here, but I just can't help myself. I'm just standing here looking at the office. It's so close.
Eventually, he gets in his car and drives home.
It feels like not getting closure. That was my opportunity to say goodbye to the office for however long this goes on. And I don't get that.
Later that day, he tells me he knows how lucky he is to still have a job, especially one where he can work from home. But this whole thing has been hard. He doesn't know when his company will send him back to the office, if ever. And like a lot of us, he hasn't had the chance to grieve his old life. I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
We're going to do a little more supply chain now, also shipping of a sort, with this observation. Crude oil rose 3.5% today, still, though, below $40 a barrel, relatively cheap since we are not flying and driving the way we used to. And that means the infrastructure that moves all that oil and gas through this economy is feeling it. Austin Golding is the president of Golding Barge Line, based out of Vicksburg, Mississippi. They move petroleum products up and down that river. Austin, it's good to talk to you again.
Good to talk to you, Kai.
Hey, so look, it occurred to me as we were thinking about calling you back that you must have operations and people, not just in Vicksburg, right, but all the way up and down the Mississippi River, which means you're dealing with state health authorities and state regulations and all of that stuff as you try to manage through this crisis, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely, especially in Texas, Louisiana, Tennessee, Florida. We employ people from 11 states that travel through all of those states to get to work. So, yeah, we've really had a lot of information to try to gather and coach around.
How are your people doing? Has anybody gotten – I mean, it's none of my business, but has anybody gotten sick?
Well, we have. We've had a few positives. Luckily, nobody has been hospitalized. But we've also been able to eliminate an outbreak on a boat, more than about two crew members.
Oh, wow.
And we've had a conference call every 2 weeks where we have the entire crew from every boat do a stand down meeting. And, we have a physician that can answer medical questions rather than us in the office trying to do that. We found that physician really gave them a lot of confidence. And when he tells you that this is real and you need to respect it and you need to take care of yourself so you can come back to work, that sounds a lot better coming from a physician than somebody that's not an expert. So that was our angle.
How much of your time as a guy running the family business, couple of hundred employees, right, trying to keep it afloat in a really bad economy, which we'll get to in a second, how much of your time is spent dealing with coronavirus and COVID and all the rest of this?
Well, I mean, it's kind of a mixture of every single decision we make. All of our business has been affected by it, every load and every discharge. So, you know, we're still making the exact same decisions we did before, but with a COVID flavor to them. I mean, it's a yeah, constant thought and a constant factor for us to consider.
Let's remember here for a second that your business is transporting petroleum products, right? And
yes,
oil
sir.
And petroleum have been getting clobbered in the market because demand is so low. That's got to be playing into you and your company's bottom line.
Absolutely. This has been the roughest disruption that we've dealt with in our company's history. And we're definitely feeling it on our end from a volume standpoint and even a speculation standpoint. People are just not moving product like they did before. They're hanging on to their capital and it's definitely being passed on to us, but we're built and focused for the future. And, you know, I think we're going to come through this a stronger company, but it's definitely painful.
You had done some things before this pandemic hit to actually grow Golding Bars Lines, right? You had made a $20 million investment into new people and new boats and all that jazz. Is that lost money now? I mean, how are you feeling about that?
Well, yeah, I tell you, I feel pretty good about it. But, yeah, it was definitely something. If we had known this was coming, that investment probably would have been dialed back. But, look, I mean, we have everything working as of today, minus about 10% of our fleet. And, you know, in the moment, it's easy to say, yeah, I wish we hadn't made that kind of investment or that large of an investment. But at the same time, I feel like we're going to be thankful we did in the long run. That investment is around assets that are going to last 30 to 40 years in the boat and barge improvements and expansions that we've done. So in the moment, yeah, it feels like a black eye, but black eyes heal.
Austin Golding down in Vicksburg, Mississippi. He runs a family business. It's called the Golding Barge Lines. Austin, thanks a bunch, man. Take care.
Absolutely, Kai. Thank you.
This final note on the way out today, which comes to us straight from the marketplace desk of what could possibly go wrong. One of the people who started Jelly Belly, it's a jelly bean maker. They're pretty good, actually. Anyway, he is, I guess, raffling off is the word you would use, a chance to win a candy factory. $50 a ticket. The plan is for 1,000 tickets to be sold in every state. You get the golden ticket, you win. David Klein, the Jelly Belly guy who's doing it, says about this project, the world needs something positive to get their minds off their problems, which really is kind of tough to argue with. Okay, we are going. Here is your midweek moment of economic context, though. It comes to us from a regular survey the Census Bureau does. It's called the Household Pulse Survey. Regular check-ins on a bunch of issues, housing insecurity, food scarcity, telework. Also, for us today, how many households are expecting a loss in income from work sometime in the next 4 weeks? Take a second guess. Give me a percentage. American families expecting a loss in income from work. More than a quarter of us, 26% of households, in this economy say they're going to lose employment income. That is paychecks, is what that is. Our media production team includes Robin Edgar, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Jay Siebold, Charlton Thorpe, Ben Tolliday, and Becca Weinman. They've been coming in so that the rest of us don't have to, unless the power and the internet are out at the shed next to your garage. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.